Explain gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. You know, it's the seasons are beginning to change. I could feel it changing. I felt like our American summer got cut a little short. Maybe our tomato season got cut a little short. We're going to talk about that. And we're going to talk about how, if you're not happy with what happened with your tomatoes, or if you'd like to make this tomato thing go on a little longer, I got a suggestion for how to do it. I got a couple of suggestions, but we'll talk about that later in the show today. We can make these tomatoes go longer. You know, there are lots of things I need to talk about today, but people have been a little upset with me because I haven't talked more about this thing that I brought up called meadow gardening, or, you know, how to grow wildflowers, I guess, is the idea in your lawn. And it's worth thinking about. I've been thinking about it a lot lately. We've talked about it. Every yard is going to be a little different. Everybody's got their own situation. But it's worth thinking about what wildflowers are and where they come from and what management is about. And, you know, here's a great thing, I'll tell you. I've been thinking about how beautiful the roadsides of Alabama once were, and how beautiful the fields once were. I can even remember this. Do you remember, this is the thing that always impresses me, this idea of fields that move. Do you remember what it was like when fields moved? When you drove by a field and there was a little ripple of wind, and it just, you could see that wind moving through the grasses in the field, moving through the wildflowers, and the wildflowers were nodding and the grasses were nodding, and it was like this ripple that just ran through the field, like it was little rivers of wind that ran through the field, running through those grasses, and the grasses would all nod at once, just kind of lay down with that wind. And it was one of the most beautiful things you've ever seen. And just to see the effect of the wind in those fields, and to see those colors, and to see the grasses change colors as they change directions. That's one of the things, the interesting things they did, is they moved from one side to the other. The whole field would change colors, and so would the flowers. Suddenly they would be knotted down, you wouldn't see them, and then they'd pop back up, and suddenly there was gold everywhere. It's incredible. Incredible the way those fields used to look. The fields that once moved. Our roadsides used to move too. They used to move as you ran past them. The grasses would wave because we didn't worry about. We mowed the roadsides once a year, and we thought that was good, and we thought that was grand. And many wildflowers that don't exist in Alabama anymore, or that are very rare, some of the last places they were found were on roadsides. It's an amazing thing. And that tells you something about how important all of that is. It's very, very important to these open areas along roadsides. These open pastures are very important to the things that make Alabama beautiful. They're very important to the wildflowers. It was the sunlight that all these plants were looking for. They couldn't find it in the deep woods that we've created, these thickets. So they looked for it along the roadsides. They looked for it in power lines. They looked for it in pastures. And so I'm watching the wildflowers come up like they used to do along Alabama roadsides, all through Alabama. And this is a beautiful stretch of road. Oh, I love this stretch of road. There were penstemons. The beautiful, beautiful penstemons, flowers that were blooming. There were beautiful phlox. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, you know, I'm going to come collect seeds here. And of course, what happens is the roadsides got mowed. It wasn't even the county. It wasn't even the county. It was people in the neighborhood, people in the area deciding that we can't have wildflowers anymore in Alabama. everything has to look like what? A golf course. Now, golf courses are fine, but you're not going to putt on the side of the road. I've been saying this over and over, but it's true. It doesn't have to look like a golf course. And so I said, you know, why do people do this? Why are they mowing the roadsides? And I think if I had to explain why people get out and mow all the time in places that didn't used to be mowed all the time, why do they do it? Well, I think they have too much time on their hands. Maybe we're all, you know, maybe retirement has given us too much time, some of you. And so we have to occupy our retirement by doing something called mowing because it's something we can do. But, you know, you don't have to mow everything all the time. And there's no benefit to mowing those roadsides. And the roadsides were more beautiful. They were more Alabama. They showed what Alabama was like. You know, the Alabama that God had a hand in. They show what it was like, and it's a lesson for us, and it's a story for us, and it's part of what makes us beautiful, and we're out there mowing it down all the time. That's the big thing I need to tell you about these meadows. So how do you in your own yard deal with this? You know, how do you make the wildflowers come back in your own yard? Sometimes, for some of us, we've mowed so much, we have mowed so often, that if you simply stop mowing, you're not going to get a lot of great wildflowers back. Because the mowing has been going on for decades, or even centuries. Literally, in parts of Midtown and downtown, we've been mowing in one way or another for many, many years. There are a few wildflowers left, not many. And so when you quit mowing, what you get are mostly random weeds that come in from Europe and South America that can survive the kind of crazy mowing habits that we now have in Alabama. So how do you get these beautiful plants back? Well, if you've got an area that hasn't been mowed for a long time, and a lot of you are moving out into the countryside, I encourage you, leave the roadsides. Don't feel obligated to mow the roadsides. If they escape the county, if they escape the county's mowing, if they escape the herbicides, don't feel like you have to mow them. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about why you mow those roadsides and why you think that's necessary. But here's the other thing. If you've got a pasture, and let's say you've got 2 acres of ground, and you've just started mowing all of it, leave a little bit of it unmowed. Just leave some little margins unmowed around the edges. Mow it just once a year. We'll talk about when to mow it. Maybe mow it just in March or just in April. Just mow it once a year and see what happens. See what some of the wildflowers that come up there, because they can be stunning and beautiful, those wildflowers that occur along the edges of woods. Just leave little borders. Leave little borders along the fence rows. You know, at one time we actually had fence rows where there were wildflowers, and we allowed the wildflowers to grow there. We don't even allow that anymore. Something's happened to us. I don't know. It's hard to explain why it is that we feel compelled to knock down all of these great wildflowers. But, you know, no need to do that anymore. If you've got a small yard, and in Mobile, I've got a small yard. It's not that big. It's part of Midtown. I got a little bit of an extra yard that is next door that I play in. But I don't have that much lawn. In the areas where I do have lawn, you know, I want to be able to walk on that comfortably. So I make little paths that run through there with grasses. And I decide I like those. And I like a little place where, you know, I mow it often enough that if my brother comes to town and if we could pretend like we were 30 years younger, we could wrestle. If that were the case. We have a little place just for grass to play in. But if I were going to take that, if I were going to let wildflowers grow, do I let wildflowers grow? Yeah. And sometimes I have to introduce those wildflowers, and you can be looking for them, and you can be thinking about them. You know, one of the great wildflowers that we have along the sides of our roads this time of year are black-eyed Susans. They're really beginning to come up everywhere. You can play with those too, and we can talk about how to manage those as part of your yard. Just in little areas. Just in little areas. But folks, let's think about this. Think about this mowing thing, which has begun to take us over. There's no need to do it everywhere. I mow. I use my mower. It's very useful at times. It makes great paths. It makes some nice areas, but we're not making golf courses everywhere. Hey, we'll be back. We're going to talk about your tomatoes. We're going to be talking about this fresh food thing. We'll be back.
Is not an iris or a wild rose, but a little flower of which I'll tell, known as Braconia Bell.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's the Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Mike and Stu brought up something that's really interesting for those of us who garden and for those of us who like to eat out. And I was listening this morning, and they brought up a great thing, and it's this idea of fresh food. And you know, one of the things we fail to understand about fresh food is that it needs to be fresh. And you know, if a restaurant's really going to serve fresh food, they're not going to be serving okra in winter, because the conditions under which that okra would have to be grown, if it were fresh, would be not really conducive to great flavor for okra. And they're not going to be serving. Maybe they're not going to serve tomatoes in winter either, at least on the Gulf Coast. I mean, they can serve them into September, October, November if the fruits are out there. We don't think about freshness the way we should. You know, one of the things that a restaurant menu can do is to change with the seasons. That's certainly what I do. And I think Charlie was going to ask, you know, on the show, he said, well, you know, what do you do during winter for vegetables? But hey, we live on the Gulf Coast. We got vegetables all during winter. And you know, those winter vegetables can be very good, but they're different than the summer vegetables. So during winter, we're eating kale, we're eating collards, we're eating turnips, we're eating mustards, we're eating arugula, we're eating, you know, the list goes on and on, of radishes, all of these great things that are part of the winter foods. We get a little bit of carryover from some of the summer foods too. Even some of our peppers last deep into the winter. All of those things are really great. And then, but you know what? If somebody's serving you kale this time of year, it ain't coming fresh from the Gulf Coast. It's coming from some factory farm in California or somewhere else. It's not the time for kale salads, right? It's very hard to even do lettuce. It's probably easier to do lettuce here than kale, simply because you pick it early and you can probably grow it in greenhouses under control conditions, and it tastes like lettuce never has much of a taste anyway, so it doesn't really hurt, I guess, to grow them hydroponically. But you know, there's so many other great things we could be doing instead of the traditional lettuces this time of year. The cucumbers are coming in. The okra does really great things. There's lots of great green bean salads and lots of wonderful things that should be happening this time of year. You know, by thinking seasonally about your garden, you come up with new ways of cooking that are really fascinating, really interesting. What if the only salad you could have all year long was lettuce salad? And that's the way we think about it. Oh man, we got to have lettuce. It's got to be lettuce. But you know, there are really the great traditional southern salads, the salads that we were once famous for that people forget about. They didn't have lettuce in them. If you ate salads in summer, you were eating cucumber salads. You were eating green bean salads, maybe a three bean salad. Do you remember all of those wonderful salads we used to have in summer that were part of the summer harvest? Part of summer harvest. I'm going to experiment this year. I'm going to experiment with salads with okra. You know, salads with okra are absolutely delicious. And people forget about the fact that you actually don't have to cook okra. You could actually just eat it raw, just slice it up. It's absolutely delicious that way. There you go. Things to think about. Eating fresh food all year long. Let's talk about that a little bit. We're also going to talk a little bit more about tomatoes, but I got some questions I need to answer. Beth doesn't want me to forget about this, but she's messaged me twice, so we're going to talk about this. How do you know when key limes are ripe in our area? You know, here's the funny thing about limes and lemons. If you're growing them right, limes and lemons are going to be ripe over a period of time. There will not be just one season when the limes are ready. Remember that we don't pick limes when they're dead ripe. We pick them before they're ripe. And the good thing about limes and lemons is that they often flower multiple times of year. So if you're growing your lime correctly, and if you're doing the best with your lime, if it's in a container particularly, you may have fruit that's ripe and that's unripe. That is, that's usable and unusable. If a lime is too ripe, it's not going to be any good anymore. It will get sweet and insipid and a little yellow and a little bit soft. So how do you know when key limes are ready to harvest? My best bet is to smell them and feel them. Squeeze them. So Beth, you're really not going to know because they're not going to get yellow. They're going to get a little bit darker green. They may go from a pale green to a darker green when they're ready to use. And then they'll turn yellow later on when they're past good. But they go from being very hard, so it's almost like there's no juice in them, to being a little bit inflated and a little soft to the touch. You don't want it to be too soft to the touch, but you should be able to grab that lemon and you just feel a little bit, it kind of feels a little juicy. And you know it's ready to use. You know it's ready to use. The good thing about key limes is that there's not a perfect time. I mean, there's not a single time, but just when they begin to get soft, they're ready to use. And again, there may be limes on that bush that are younger than other limes, and they may not be ready to pick. So you don't want to pick every lime at once on a key lime plant, and that's okay. Beth, does that help? There's not a particular time of year when they're harvestable. It just doesn't work that way with limes. They're harvestable all year long, particularly if they're flowering all year long. And as long as they don't get too soft. There it is. That's how we think about it. Fertilizer for bananas. Another question we got from our texting. Bananas, here's what I used to fertilize my bananas. And you want to get that fertilizer on back in March and April and May. That's when it makes the most difference. Particularly in March. Bananas love ashes. I'm just serious. I mean, there is nothing you could do for a banana to make it happier than to find some fireplace ashes and spread it around that banana. It loves it. Particularly if you've got some leaves laying around that you've mixed it with. It's just perfect. It's absolutely perfect. And so that's it. What do ashes contain? Well, there are a lot of things that ashes have. One of the most important things that ashes have is potassium. And potassium is a very, very important ingredient of any synthetic fertilizer, any artificial fertilizer. The synthetic fertilizers that we produce from nitrogen, and that's the chemical fertilizers that come in a bag that are the little granules, or that come in the Miracle-Gro. Those are things that are produced from basically from fuel stocks. They're produced from natural gas, and those kinds of fertilizers, you want them to have a lot of potassium and a good bit of nitrogen. So any fertilizer that's a synthetic fertilizer, commercial fertilizer, that's relatively high in nitrogen and relatively high in potassium is good. So it could be 6-3-6 or 12-6-12. The first number and the last number are the two important numbers. You definitely want that last number to be as high as the first number when you're dealing with bananas. You want those two numbers on either end. There are three numbers that they list on the fertilizer bag. You want those two numbers on either end to sort of be even. That would be good for bananas. If I add ashes to those bananas along with leaves, they almost can survive just on that. But oftentimes I'll add a little cottonseed meal with it too, because it's easy to do. I don't have to think about it. It's not complicated. And they'll do just fine. But it's the potassium that they really love, and that's the thing you want to look for. Got some other interesting texts that we're going to answer this morning. Mike near Walnut Hill has a two-acre meadow ready for wildflowers. Any idea how to seed? Mike, let's talk about what's in that meadow. If you give me a little bit of a hint about what's in that meadow and how to deal with it, we'll think about how to do it. And sometimes finding the right seed, it requires a little bit of work, but I'm going to tell you where to go. We're going to talk about how to find some of the best sources. There's a great one called Round Seeds, and we're going to talk about how to get to that. We're on a break. We're going to be back. We're going to talk about your tomatoes.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Mike in Walnut Hill has a great, beautiful area. Walnut Hill's a great area. It's been used for crops a lot, but there's still some remnant areas where there's a lot of great wildflowers left. Mike, that area might have been under pasture management or under field management for a long time. Be interesting to know the history of the site. If I know a little bit about the history, it's easier to predict what's going to come up. There are a lot of things that you can bring back in a field like that. One of the first things you want to do, and it's very important for the wildflowers, is to begin to encourage, in a field like that, encourage the clumping grasses. There will always be grasses in a field like that. You'll never have just pure wildflowers. The grasses can be as beautiful as the wildflowers. In fall, there's nothing more beautiful than a bunch of plum-stemmed grasses, just absolutely purplish or orange, deep orange or purple, depending on the species, just waving in those fall winds. That's part of what makes a pasture beautiful, are the grasses. The native grasses were clumping grasses. They were grasses that grew in clumps, and unlike lawn grasses, which tend to make this dense mat in which nothing else grows. So you want to get those clumping grasses back. When you get the clumping grasses back, it's the backbone that everything else builds around. And so it's very easy. It's broom sedge. That was the old term. You remember the term broom sedge? Some people said broom sage. That's whichever. It's uh, it was one of the great beautiful grasses of the Gulf Coast. It's sort of great beautiful grasses of Alabama. It healed the forest in so many different ways. So you can be thinking about those and how to get those grasses back. Look for those in your field. Look for the clumping grasses, not the ones that spread, but the clumpers. They're going to be the ones that are very, very important to getting this field back. You sent me a picture, and you've got a great picture. It's of a European clover. The European clovers are abundant there. It's a good indication that pasture was managed at one time for cows, and it's been mowed a lot, I suspect, frequently. And so what you're going to do now to get the clumping grasses back is you're going to mow it a lot less. Mow it a lot less. When you have your goats, if you're going to put goats in there and you still want some wildflowers, have the goats, don't let the goats roam freely over the whole plot. Put you up a little electric fence. This is good for the goats and good for the pasture. It's a great way to manage pasture. And let them eat one area really good and then move them to another area. And that way you manage your pasture better. You don't let them just browse out all the really good stuff. And it's a much better way of browsing a pasture. So we can talk about that. But, you know, I think, and particularly for goats, getting those clump grasses back can make a big difference. And you can really end up with some great wildflowers if you do that. So Mike, if you want to talk a little bit more about that, be sure to call me and we'll figure it out. We'll think about it. The little flowers you sent me pictures of, the white flowers, are a Regeron. That's Robin's plant, and it's one of the native plants. The other ones, with the kind of a bushy top, or white clover or red clover. I'm not sure which, probably red clover. Dan, good to see those pictures of black vernissage. I'm really interested. It's a great tomato. Interested to see here how they do for you. Can we talk about tomatoes just a minute? You know, a lot of folks are going to be nearing the end of their tomato harvest this time of year, and that's, you know, that's just the way it's going to happen, because the days are going to get too hot. It's going to be frustrating. You're saying, well, gosh, I wish I'd had more tomatoes. I wish I'd started earlier. I wish things had been better, etc. Here's the thing to do if you want more tomatoes, and this is the time of year to start doing it. You could right now start from seed a tomato. This is a good time. This is the crazy part about the Gulf Coast. You either want to start your tomatoes back in January or early February, or you want to start them in June. And here's the funny thing about tomatoes. If you start your tomatoes in June, get them started in June, July, August, September, that's about 90 days. That means those tomatoes are going to start ripening in September when the nights get cooler, when we start getting less rain. You see what I'm saying? Start your tomatoes, if you start your tomatoes here in the last 2 weeks of June, get them started in the last 2 weeks of June, plant them out in July. The young tomatoes are more resistant to diseases. They're not as susceptible to diseases. They grow better. They're not stopping to produce fruits, so they're gonna grow through those diseases. They're gonna grow through the wet spells of summer. You're not gonna have to worry about all of the problems that you normally have to worry about as long as you got decent soil. Start them the last 2 weeks in June. You'll be harvesting tomatoes starting in mid-September, October, November, December. It is potentially the longest tomato harvest season of the year. There are problems that come with fall harvest, no question. We got more caterpillars, we got more stink bugs, the tomatoes ripen more slowly because the days are getting shorter, but you can have some potentially some great tomatoes in fall. So it's something to think about. It's something to think about. Now, I will also tell you, I think that, I guess if I were going to grow a big fat tomato, the best time of year to do that may be in fall. But I still like the small tomatoes best. The flavor on those small tomatoes is just absolutely incredible. And if you get some of the great smaller tomatoes, Matt's Wild Cherry, the Mexico Midget, that have this incredible flavor, the one called Coyote or Coyote, this tomato from Veracruz province along the Gulf Coast, the kind of tomato I would call a traditional Gulf Coast tomato. Those tomatoes are going to be much more productive. They're going to do really well. And this is a pretty good time. It's a pretty good time to start them. Pretty good time to start them. So you can be thinking about that if you want to prolong your tomato season. Some people this time of year will take cuttings. And this is the time to do it. You just take a tip cutting from your healthy tomato. Find a piece of your tomato that doesn't have a lot of flowers on it, just a vegetative stem that doesn't have a lot of flowers on it. Take the top 6 inches, make sure it's got no diseases or anything, and it looks really healthy. Take about that top 6 inches, strip off the bottom rank of leaves, and stick it in some moist soil in a little container. Don't put it in full sun, just give it a little bit of sunlight. Those tomatoes will root. Take about 5 or 6 cuttings and stick them there. You'll have a young tomato that has all the attributes of a young tomato. You can do that in the next 2 weeks. And then you can replant that tomato in, you know, early to mid-July. And that tomato will produce in September and November. Really good idea. Something that people on the Gulf Coast used to do a lot. I think it's great to start from seeds. Just start fresh from, get some new seeds. Great time to start from seeds. Seeds are going to come up really fast. They're going to grow really well through July, even when the other tomatoes are flagging because they're trying to produce tomatoes. But those young seedlings are going to do really, really well. Something to think about. Something to think about with your tomatoes as you're moving up. Well, it's... And it is Father's Day today. I think about my dad and his growing tomatoes. I think about the comment today from one of the great men who said that happy Father's Day to all, including my critics, of whom there are far fewer now. Well, so happy Father's Day to folks. Happy Father's Day to my dad, who's really great with tomatoes and really had a great prospect for tomatoes. He's decided he's not going to grow tomatoes anymore, but that's okay. We learned a lot about growing tomatoes together, and something that's really good. So. David Hubble tells me, you know, and this is the classic case with tomatoes this time of year, that his tomatoes did really well until we started getting those big rains. Then they started getting shriveled leaves and plants started dying. You know, David, if the death was pretty quick, if it was sudden death, that's not a playoff. It's a description for how tomatoes react under certain conditions to a disease called bacterial wilt. If those plants died suddenly, you have a disease called bacterial wilt. And we can talk about that. It's really about the soil being super saturated. It's one of the reasons why I haven't had bacterial wilt in a while. And the reason I don't is because I grow my tomatoes in that thick layer of organic matter. You know, I always put down a fresh layer of leaves that are decomposed for about 6 months that sits about 6 inches, 3 to 6 inches above the normal soil. And when the roots of the tomato get into that, they're pretty resistant to the bacterial wilt. And I have a feeling that a lot of people are going to be seeing that bacterial wilt problem. But David, call in. Let's talk about your tomatoes, how to fix that, because... You know, even with heirloom types, even with old-fashioned types, modern types, old-fashioned types, they're all going to be really susceptible to bacterial wilt. And there's a way to fix bacterial wilt. We'll talk about it when we come back. Give us a call. 343-0106.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Through the window, by the window, that is where all become tiptoe, through the tulips.
You know, you just don't even want to talk over it. Just can kind of put you off for a while, but it's done. It's done for the day. We think that was the last of Tiny Tim. Hey, you know, we have a lot of cool things to talk about this morning, including tomatoes. Dan sent me a picture of one of his tomatoes that died very suddenly. And it was in a container, and he said it wasn't during when the rains came. It was during the drought. A lot of things happen to tomatoes in containers because it's very hard to regulate the moisture just right, as you know. It's easy to overwater. It's easy to underwater. I don't know what kind of soil you had in the containers. If it's sterile soil, I wouldn't, you know, it lessens the chances that it was bacterial wilt. If there was any soil mixed in with loam from the garden, there's a chance that that bacterial wilt could have spread through the plant. But there are lots of diseases, Pythium and Phytophthora, that can affect a plant in a container simply because it's very hard to regulate moisture in a container. And sometimes it's easy to overwater, and sometimes it's easy to underwater. Dan, the one thing I would recommend with container plants that can sometimes help is to bottom water them as much as possible. So if you take your plants, and find a container, find something. In fact, I have a container that's a pretty planter that doesn't have a hole in the bottom that holds water. And I will fill that with water, and I will just put my big plants in there, let them absorb that water from the base, rotate around like that, and it makes a big difference in regulating moisture. And I could go into all the details why, but that's pretty important. Having soil that isn't too dense is also pretty important. I'd be interested in what kind of soil you had that you were growing those tomatoes in. So let me know what kind of soil that was and where you got it. Some dirt from the garden. Yep, that probably explains it. It may be bacterial wilt, and it just the conditions are right. There's always some bacterial wilt in our soils. And David Hubble, you on there?
I'm here.
Yep. So just talking to Dan about his plants and containers. I think he had bacterial wilt in his containers too, simply from using the garden soil. You know, here's an interesting thing about bacterial wilt is always in your soil. The folks used to say, the extension agents used to say, if you get bacterial wilt, you can never grow tomatoes in that soil again. Well, the trouble is, virtually everybody who grows tomatoes is going to get bacterial wilt, which means nobody would ever be able to grow tomatoes again. But David, I think you probably had bacterial wilt. Describe what happened to me.
Well, you know, I do mine in raised beds.
And
go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm listening.
Okay, now, I do mine in raised beds, but I've been keeping my oak leaves for years and letting them mulch down, compost down.
Yeah,
my grass clippings and a few. you know, vegetable trimmings from the kitchen compost. And every year I'll just turn them over with a pitchfork like you described and kind of work some more in if I need to add more to that soil.
Yeah.
And so I planted my tomatoes. I've also started adding the rabbit droppings, as I told you earlier. And I planted the tomatoes in there, and everything did fine, and they were growing well. But we got the first really, or the couple of days of heavy rains, and then I try to pull the bottom leaves off to make sure I'm not getting anything splashed up there. But gradually, one or two of them would just start to wilt and just shrivel up.
Right. And that wilt and shrivel up, it would suddenly you'd see the wilt, and then over two or three days the plant would die. Is that
right.
Basically what happened? Yeah. So that there's no question that's bacterial wilt. That's easy to diagnose. It's the only disease that really acts like that. It happens very quickly. Your tomatoes doing well, the leaves begin to wilt a little bit, you think, oh, I got to water it. You water it more, and then two or three days later, it's gone.
Right.
And once it gets bacterial wilt, once it just, David, I need to say for folks, once it gets that bacterial wilt disease, there's nothing you can do. I mean, it's internal to the plant. There's nothing you can spray on the outside of the plant. You can't do surgery to remove the bacterial wilt because it's all through the plant. So, you know, you're kind of stuck with it. And besides, it happens so rapidly that by the time you notice the wilting, it's going to die within two or three days anyway.
Right.
So here's the one thing I can say about that. There may be nothing you can do given the heaviness of some of the rains that we have now and how frequently we have these very heavy rains. But in general, I have found that if you build the beds up enough, and it's the most important thing is to have a new fresh layer of leaves. I always start out where I'm planting my tomatoes because of that bacterial wilt problem. I always start off with a pile of leaves about 3 or 4 feet high where I'm going to plant my tomatoes. Put those in fall, let mm-hmm. those molder down, and they're going to create a pretty high layer of fresh soil on top of the other soil. And David, the other thing I would say is don't, and you may not be doing it, but don't turn that soil in. You know,
that's
the
what
old,
I've been doing.
In the, yeah, don't turn it in. You want it to develop just like a forest does.
Right.
And I know that the soil is on top, that organic dense or the high organic layer with the leaves is on top, not mixed in. And that creates that layer that these plants can grow in where it's impossible. It's almost impossible to saturate that layer of organic matter on top as long as you don't turn it in. So mm-hmm. next year, and it's particularly important now that you've got bacterial wilt, don't turn it in. And I can just tell you, there's a lot of folks out there and there's a lot of books out there that say turn the soil in. I don't know why they say to turn it in. I don't see any benefits to doing that, but I can particularly tell you from my experience on the Gulf Coast, if you want the benefits of organic matter, do not turn it into the soil. Leave it on top. Let those roots grow in that dense, rich organic layer. And if you go out into the woods, that's exactly what's happening in most of our soils. You'll see that the roots are concentrated in that first 3 or 4 inches where it's almost all organic matter, with a few roots penetrating down into the sand and into the other areas beneath there. So have I said enough, David?
Yeah, I think so. I think what I just need to get in the habit of doing is instead of just creating a compost pile is after I've picked the tomatoes and cucumbers out of that bed is just make that my compost pile.
That's exactly right. And that's the big thing is that, you know, you can't, and I keep saying this, the idea of having a compost pile separate from the garden, it probably works in Boston just fine.
Mm-hmm.
It don't work here.
Yeah.
You've got to build your compost because you mostly need the organic matter. That's more important than the kitchen scraps.
Got to go to break.
Are those leaves. Yeah, I got to go to break. Hey, David, thanks for calling in.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah. We'll be back, folks, after this news break.
Have a little song.